Take a network break. Steep a nice hot cup of tea, visualize the perfect virtual donut, and join us as we apply analysis and snark to today's tech news. I'm your host, Drew Conry Murray, and joining me fresh from a command performance at Interop is Greg Farrow. Greg, how you doing?
My eyeballs are about 6 inches outside my face. My body doesn't know whether it's come or going. Yes, it's the post-Interop jet lag.
Jet lag.
Jet lag, yes. And just so many people, like, you know, when you don't leave the house and all of a sudden you get shoved into the middle of a conference and every day starts at 7:30 and finishes at 10:30 and repeat, surrounded by people and things and talking, and just, it's fantastic, but it's exhausting.
Before we jump into the news, thanks to today's sponsors. This episode of Network Break is brought to you by IT Pro TV. Enhance your technology aptitude. IT Pro TV is the resource to keep your IT skills up to date with engaging and informative video tutorials. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, go to itprotv.com/networkbreak and use the code NETWORKBREAK30, and we'll have a link in the show notes. I also want to thank GNS3. Right now, the GNS3 Training Academy includes the Practical SDN and OpenFlow Fundamentals course, and the first 50 listeners to respond can get 50% off. Just go to academy.gns3.com and use the coupon packetpushers, all one word, to get your discount. All right, jumping into the news, we mentioned Interop, and you were on a keynote panel. You moderated a keynote panel at Interop on the effects of open source on IT and networking. You had panelists from GitHub, Walmart Labs, which we've talked about in previous shows, and Dimension Data. Network Computing has a good overview of the discussion, and they pulled out three key points. I thought we'd go over them.
Yeah. Let's see if they match up to the ones I was trying to make.
That's right, yeah. See if you actually achieved your objective.
Perception is reality, right? People
That's right.
pick up on, you think you're going out there and you're going to say something, and then people hear something completely differently. So that'll be interesting. This will be fun.
Okay, yeah. You said your piece. Let's see how people received it.
Yep.
Okay, so one, open source gives network owners and operators an opportunity to innovate for themselves rather than just waiting around for a vendor to do it. So by participating in open source projects, you can actually drive some innovation in your environment. Is that a point that you had tried to make?
No.
All right. 0 for 1.
I think tangentially I touched on the point that open source allows you to move faster, in the sense that because it's free, you don't have to go through a gap analysis, needs analysis, and then you do pricing based on the gap and the value to the business, and then you go and raise a quotation to address that, and you go through the process of quotations and analyzing how much it would cost, and then you finally buy something, and then you finally deliver something.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's pretty hard to have what's called a pace of innovation when you have to go through, you know, wet cement to get there.
Sure.
Open source solves that by just going from zero to proof of concept.
Right.
Well,
absolutely.
Which does allow innovation, but doesn't inherently allow. No, that's not what I was talking about at all.
Okay, all right, let's try number two.
Let's try number two.
Point number two, don't just leech off open source projects. Organizations that use open source should contribute back, in part because by participating, you bring essential knowledge into the organization about the project, and also because without contributors and an active community, projects just die.
Fair summary. My actual point here was the corporate influence in open source. And so we have open source projects which have substantial corporate input and participation, and those people contribute code. So they can, and he who contributes code determines the future of projects. Corporations have money. Money buys developers. Developers determine the future of open source projects, and they can be good or evil when wielding that power,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
This leads to some outcomes. Like, you look at OpenStack, there's over 300 corporations now involved, like big money. Companies from, you know, HPE, Cisco, IBM, all contributing like mega bucks to OpenStack.
And mega bucks and mega developers, yeah.
Yeah, and they all force it in a particular direction. I mean, the reason why OpenStack is confusing is because, not only because it's such a big thing, OpenStack has, you know, storage, compute, networking, it's got orchestration, it's trying to be everything to everybody, but you've got all of these corporations duking it out. So considering that open source really started as a process of political defiance, you know, we reject the overlord, the evil overlords.
Right.
So the real question I had was, are corporations embracing open source or extinguishing it? You know, can they kill it? And can they transcend the tribe?
Mm-hmm.
So that was one point. The second point I wanted to discuss, and was the last one we managed to get in the time available, is that maintenance and longevity is better than innovation. That is, if you've got an open source project like OpenStack, it takes years for it to mature and get adopted. So the main thing these projects need to focus on is maintenance and being around in the long term. But on the other hand, open source allows people to spin up projects and die rapidly, and that undermines faith in the whole open source projects. The second part of contributions is that companies that consume open source are expected to contribute back, but they aren't. Amazon, I've talked about this before, Amazon gives very little back to open source, at least not in public. It doesn't fund any open source projects, as far as I know. Its developers don't give much back, as far as I know. If they do, they do it on their own time, not on company time. And yet they're sucking $10 billion a year out of that value of that open source. That's to build a business that has no, you know, commercial software in it at all, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. So corporations need to, A, be careful of their influence. If they extinguish a project, then they can't feed off it. And unless they deliberately want to spike a competitor, of course.
Right.
And we need to be careful to make sure that not only do corporations do it, but customers. So if you work for a big bank like Walmart or whatever, not even a big bank really, a big company like Walmart, they're contributing back to open source. They have developers in OpenStack. They have the OneOps tool that they're using. And Sean was saying, you know, he's from Walmart and contributes to the OneOps. And he said the key point about what he wanted to make was that they see contributing back to open source as a key part of keeping it going.
That's right, because they have a vested interest in using open source software, and so they want to make sure that the project stays alive. And one way to do that is to be in the community and actively contributing back.
Yes. Yeah, you've got to give it back. If you're not giving the code back to people, if you're not contributing, seen to be contributing also, you can't just do it quietly in the background. If you're quietly contributing code in the background, then you're not going to get the benefits of open source.
That's right. All right, so the third point that I pulled out of this article, this summary article, is that the open source model can actually have benefits to how your own organization operates, particularly around collaborative problem solving and getting people outside of their cylinders of excellence.
Wow, Chinese whispers. I've got no idea. I think the second point I wanted to make is that open source is kind of killing off the standards bodies. We look at open source projects, they're executing, they're innovating, they're delivering, you know, they're cycling over products very fast. Some projects die, some projects are successful. But in the past, we've always waited for the IETF or even worse, the IEEE to do things to define standards. And yet open source is just going straight past them and ignoring them completely. So one part is, you know, that solves problems that we don't need to wait for standards bodies anymore. And those bodies increasingly look like they're obsolete. But I'm not. The collaborative problem solving is also about is just a different thing that I'm not sure where that would have come from.
Okay, well, I think that was a comment that one of the panelists made. So maybe that's something that the reporter picked
up
on.
Oh yes, obviously, with once you're starting to write code and working with the developers closely, whether the person writing apps, then the cylinders of excellence break down. Mm-hmm. Instead of having silos, you start to understand more about what's going on. The thing that's really causing cylinders of excellence, of course, isn't the engineers themselves. It's the management of engineers. That's a problem, project silos, and their inability to cope with in a grown-up way with orchestration and team management.
Mm-hmm. All right, so there's a link to this article. You can go and compare. And Greg also has posted his own show notes. We'll have a link to that as well, so you can see just what message Greg wanted to send and what message was actually taken away.
Yes. So I blogged the notes I wrote as the questions and the dialogue that I created. But, yeah, there you
go. Go and take a look. Go and take a look and make your own opinions. Sticking with open source, CoreOS, which we've talked about now and then, they make a commercially supported version of Kubernetes, which is itself a container orchestration platform. The CoreOS just got $28 million from a variety of VCs to continue development of its Tectonic platform. Tectonic is its commercially supported version of Kubernetes. Investors include Google Ventures, Y Combinator, Kleiner, Perkins, Caulfield, and Byers, among others. And this is a B round of funding. CoreOS already put together $20 million, so it's $48 million going into the CoreOS project.
Now, this is quite interesting. I learned something this week, which is the suggestion that somebody made to me is that Google only open sources software that it's no longer using. That is, it's not giving away a competitive advantage. So if you can imagine that Kubernetes is something that Google used to use or was developed to promote the use of containers because that suits Google's cloud platform. Uh-huh. Or something, but in a sense, once Google's open source something, it's sort of like push the boat out, set it on fire, and walk away.
Viking funeral for that project.
A little like that. And it if you as long as somebody jumps on and puts out the fire, they can have the boat, sort of thing. So it looks to me like CoreOS might be very wisely jumping on Kubernetes. CoreOS, of course, is in direct competition with Docker. If you measure a company's success in column inches in the press and the hyperbole that you see on Twitter, CoreOS needs to go up the stack to get ahead of Docker, mm-hmm. because Docker's still focused around the container itself. And this could be good for them. Now, particularly, it means that there's now a corporate version of Kubernetes and container orchestration. This isn't just creating containers and using them. This is the same as if you think of Docker as what VMware does with ESX, they just, here's containers and we do some orchestration of a few containers. Kubernetes says, let's treat the whole container thing like a cloud, and having a commercial version with some funding behind it to go and get some Red Hat type support, you know, the model that Red Hat put together, then that's a good thing if you're into containers. I'm not sure containers really matter yet. I think they're still years away.
Still very early, but lots and lots of column inches.
You know, but the thing is, of course, in the enterprise is you're on a 5 to 10 year vision, so you need to start keeping an eye on containers so that when it comes, you've got a network that's ready for it, or some of your decisions are made with containers in mind.
And keeping that in mind, as a side note, if you want to get an intro to CoreOS and Tectonic, the Datanauts did a podcast on about it recently, and we'll have a link in the notes if you want to do a little deep dive.
Yeah, just since you mentioned Datanauts, you should remember that the Datanauts is available for sponsorship. So if you're a vendor listening to this show, maybe you want to sponsor the Datanauts to get your message in front of 10,000 odd people.
A little plug to our Datanauts friends.
Yeah, just a little one.
And speaking of plugs, I want to tell you a little bit more about today's sponsor, IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV gives you access to the most important tools you need to prepare for your IT certifications. That includes over 1,000 hours of up-to-date, high-quality video content. New courses are added weekly. And Greg, you want to tell us a little bit more about what we can get from IT Pro TV?
So IT Pro TV is another way to get training and knowledge into your life. Over 1,000 hours of up-to-date, high-quality video content and lots of new stuff being added weekly. Courses are both recorded live, and what I mean by recorded live is they literally record them live, so you can watch them as they're done, and then they're later edited and then published up there for you to get any time. You can read about them on your Chromecast, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, wherever you are. You can even read them in the toilet on your favorite mobile device. Course topics include, you know, the usuals, CompTIA, CACNP, security, Microsoft Server, ethical hacking, and so forth. But you also get 100 step-by-step virtual machine labs and Transcender practice exam. So if you're in using this material as a step towards sitting through some certifications, you've now got access to the Transcender practice exams where you can rehearse the examination process. And there's just one low monthly subscription price, and no hassle cancellation policy, and there's some corporate pricing available. So maybe you can go and knock on the door of your boss and say, pony up.
That's right.
You might have canceled my training budget, but give me this instead.
That's right. So please go check out itpro.tv/networkbreak to upgrade your brain with the most popular IT certifications. Premium subscriptions are normally $57 a month or $570 per year, but there's a special offer for our listeners. You can try it free for 7 days when you sign up using the code NETWORKBREAK30. You can check out their courses, live stream, and more. You'll also receive 30% off the lifetime of your account, and that's less than $40 a month or $399 for the entire year. Thanks, IT Pro TV, for being a sponsor. All right, some more news. We were at Interop. We had a lot of products coming out, a lot of news coming at us, and a couple of stories that came out of there. Cloud-managed networks seem to be a thing, a growing trend, and Huawei is announcing a cloud-managed network platform, which, as the name helpfully tells you, lets you manage your network gear from the cloud, including switches, access routers, APs, firewalls. Right now, the platform is only available for testing by managed service providers, but it's expected to be generally available next year.
Yeah, this is really interesting move by Huawei. And let me just try and draw a parallel. Those of you who are familiar with what Cisco Meraki division has done with this idea of devices on site, cloud platforms outside, which is a very IoT way of doing things, Huawei's now built one of those. It's not just for service providers, but they're going to start there. So service providers can manage an edge switching device or an edge platform around the network. And then in the future, it's going to go into the enterprise. And it's not just going to do a switch or a few bits and pieces. It's going to do everything: wireless, data center switching, campus switching, Wi-Fi, the whole nine yards. That's their, you know, it's a big story. It's not just like Meraki sort of says, yeah, we're targeting the SME, but Huawei says, no, we're going to do all of it.
We're going to do all the things.
Yes.
And sticking with that, Extreme Networks also announced an offering to manage APs and wired networking equipment from the cloud, and they're rolling out three models of access switches and an edge switch that you can manage from the cloud.
Yes, so Extreme Networks has changed radically since we last spoke about them about 6 to 9 months ago. We got to meet them during Interop, and they basically were pointing out that they too have moved to embrace the whole merchant silicon thing, which I seem to remember is something I might have said a long time ago, is that Extreme is most likely to go in this direction. So they're now using merchant silicon APs, merchant silicon wired networking, and they're now changing their differentiation away from, you know, custom software with fancy management platforms too. It's all in the cloud. You put a switch down, it can't let it get out to the internet, and then it can be managed externally. In particular, we spoke a lot about its impact on educational networks and how resellers can go in and install a network and then year on year stay in touch with the customer and provide services that just keep going from month to month.
That's right. It gives them a touch point back into that customer.
That's right. I think it's a very powerful way to go. You know, this cloud platform thing. I've always been a big complainer about network monitoring, having recently described the state of network monitoring, the ashes of network monitoring products for the last 10, 20 years mm-hmm. as a Sauron-sized mountain of tears. One of my greatest lines ever. I might get that chiseled into my gravestone. That's just... But probably not. That's just, I'm trying to joke. I'm probably saying it too far. Yeah. Really impressed to see Extreme sort of turning it around. They're taking what was the previous generation, the Enterasys management platform, and turning it into a cloud service that you can use on site. So hopefully that keeps them going and gives them a niche in the network that they can exploit.
Well, Extreme, through their acquisition of Enterasys, has actually had a pretty good run in the wireless space. They do a lot of stadiums. You said education. So they're really, you know, carving out a strong niche for themselves.
Yeah, great. Which is great because Extreme's had some really great products. There's more there than you think.
And we were walking the floor at Interop and checking in on a few companies that we don't normally talk about. And one jumped out at you, Greg, Monit Corp.
Yeah, these guys make little wireless sensors. They're about the size of a 50-cent piece. I don't know. What's the size of a 50-cent piece in American money for our American audience?
25 cents, quarter.
Yeah, okay. I guess. I don't know what that looks like. But anyway... roughly, you know, sort of 2.5 centimeters across, little tiny sensors. They start at $50, and you can just throw them all around your building, and they all talk over a wireless network that is also a gateway, which then goes up to a central cloud platform. You can either have it on-site or you can have it off-site, and all the data from the sensors gets put up there, and then you use a drag-and-drop interface to show what the sensors are. Just really, really neat, because these sensors are temperature, humidity, vibration, open-shut, proximity sensors, lots and lots of different ones. But the guy, funny story, he said his daughter had a boy coming around, so he put a sensor on the window so he could find out if the window was open.
Oh, dear.
I'm not too sure what that says about his parenting skills.
You can't automate parenting, but sometimes
no,
you need a little help.
Maybe it's just one of those things. So I just thought that was interesting. He was talking to me about different factory plants that have been putting these sensors on to do things, and some of them had saved, you know, they'd spent like $50,000 in sensors and software and project money to save $2 million a year by just monitoring the vibration. By putting the sensor on and monitoring the vibration of this shaft, they could predict when it needed to be taken down. Because as the vibration got worse, the bearings were wearing. And because they could see the chart, they could actually just say, this is going to go in 3 or 4 months and blah, blah, blah. So really interesting stuff.
All right.
Cheap, really cheap way to get started. And it's interesting. It might be a good way to do a proof of concept or a pilot before you go into maybe a bigger solution. You know?
Yeah, great idea.
At very least.
And I stopped by the Live Action booth. They're doing interesting things around network performance, monitoring, and management. They got a great dashboard, some excellent visualizations, and they've also got a really strong play around QoS configuration. They've got a configuration manager. It helps you manage your configs. You can identify misconfigurations and easily push out new ones. So if you're looking at network and application performance monitoring, go check out Live Action.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Live Action. If I had to monitor QoS, you know my theory on QoS.
I do.
I don't believe that quality of service ever works. It only matters when you have quantity of service. In other words, more bandwidth.
More bandwidth.
But if you are into the position where you think QoS is necessary, Live Action is the shiz, quite honestly. It does all the things. It's astonishing. Does it extract the data from each of the buffer of the queues in the QoS policy, it actually charts them in a way that you can actually make sense of it. That's mm-hmm. the amazing trick they've done here is their data visualization and the user interface. Not the fact that it pulls the data from the QoS is a good thing,
right.
But not genius. The genius is in the data presentation to me.
Yeah, the visualizations are pretty good. Mm-hmm. And our friends at Alcatel-Lucent Enterprise released a whole bunch of new products.
Yeah, talking about networking vendors that you don't normally hear about, Alcatel-Lucent Enterprise, as opposed to Alcaloo, the rest of Alcatel-Lucent that went to Nokia, just to make sure that you don't know. Alcatel-Lucent Enterprise continues as a standalone company. It was acquired by a Chinese vendor some time back, and they continue to do their thing. So they're now focusing on supporting mobility and IoT. So you might see that there's a trend for some vendors to go off and support Internet of Things. So what they've done is they've produced more Wave 2 Wi-Fi access points, because you need more devices, so that's good for supporting more devices. But a hardened and ruggedized gigabit LAN access switch, they actually had it sitting in a freezer on the show floor.
An actual freezer, right? Yeah, they did.
Freezer, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, stick a switch in a freezer and it's still running.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like -5 degrees or -10 degrees Celsius. I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit for the one country in the world that still does Fahrenheit.
USA. USA.
USA. Ahead by being behind on that one, I think.
I guess.
But I thought that was a pretty neat idea. We also saw Dell release something like this, you know, ruggedized IoT type thing a while back. And I know Cisco's got some ruggedized Ethernet in its industrial division. But good to see Alcatel-Lucent extending the OmniSwitch into severe situations. And they also iterated their chassis-based LAN switch. More density, more things, more whatever's probably running the usual sorts of things that next generation of chassis would have.
Yeah,
good to see.
The OmniSwitch 9900.
Yeah, ALE, of course, is still supporting shortest path bridging. Avaya and ALE are doing shortest path bridging. I remain a huge fan of the shortest path bridging technology. I'm not 100% sure, but I remain a little cautious around, you know, deploying a business. But for IoT, SPB is the absolute thing. It's a really amazing idea.
And SPB was a competing standard to Trill, is that right?
Yeah, well, shortest path bridging was the IEEE standard, and Trill came out because Trill actually moved like in a reasonable time frame. Well, less than a decade. By the time SPB hit the market, you know, IEEE sort of futzed around for so long, the market just moved on and became, couldn't get any, you know, you've got to move fast if you're going to move standards or if you want to move the market. If there's a problem, you have to solve it. You can't futz around like the IEEE does for a year, 5 years, 10 years, and expect people to care. So the thing that Cisco uses in their Nexus 2000 with its fabric extensions, that's also an IEEE invention. It's not actually Cisco's idea. And that's used to be called 802.1GBH, and it went on to become 802.1BR. And, you know, you just can't – by the time it came out, we'd moved on. Mm-hmm. Merchant Silicon just made all that work obsolete because they'd futzed around for too long. I got a little angry at the IEEE guy, didn't I?
Oh, we had a meeting with someone from the Ethernet Alliance, and Greg just kind of unloaded with all his frustrations on the IEEE. It's interesting to watch. He took it well. He defended his position.
He reminded me about this concept of fair and reasonable and non-discriminatory patent licensing.
Mm-hmm.
So fundamentally, it looks like the reason that the IEEE exists now, and I'm going to go off and research this a little bit more, but the IEEE fundamentally exists so that companies can make patents and then turn them into IEEE standards so that they can exploit revenue from that.
Well, I think he wouldn't necessarily argue that it is revenue exploitation, but they understand that people are bringing IP to the table, and so there has to be some kind of mechanism for compensation and also for IP protection. So,
yeah, but it's Ethernet, right? It's not hard. This isn't rocket science. Like, the thing is, back in the day when there was FIDI and ATM and Token Ring, it was a real gamble to bring Ethernet standards to market because you couldn't monetize them. There was no guarantee.
Right.
But in 2016, guess what?
Ethernet
Any Ethernet technology, you're going to sell.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So exactly why you would try to take money up front, like I want to exploit my patents that I've got by doing fundamental research, and then I want to exploit it by making products that I sell on them, that just seems to be like a problem to me. That seems to be like wrong incentives.
All right. Well, maybe we can reach out to that guy and get him on the show, and you guys can have it out. But I'm not going to pretend to be an advocate for his side without him here. And I want to get you off your unicorn before we take this off the rails. So let's take another moment to thank our other sponsor today, GNS3. You know GNS3 for their network lab software. Well, they've also started a training academy. And right now, the GNS3 Academy includes the Practical SDN and OpenFlow Fundamentals course from David Bombal. And you, as a fine, intelligent Packet Pushers listener, you can get 50% off. If you're looking for a practical, hands-on, real-world approach to learning and implementing SDN and OpenFlow, look no further. This course from GNS3 Academy offers a unique way to learn about SDN with no risk, using your own laptop along with free or demo software. And in the course, the instructor, and he's a CCIE emeritus, David Bombal, demonstrates SDN and OpenFlow in detail. He covers everything from basic definitions to capturing messages with Wireshark. You can even see how to build your own SDN switch with a Raspberry Pi. That's pretty cool. So the first 50 listeners to register receive the course for 50% off. You can register now by going to tinyurl.com/GNS3SDN or go to academy.gns3.com. Use the coupon PacketPushers, all one word, to get your discount. And of course, we will have those links in the show notes. Moving on, you had a story from H3C and Tsinghua.
That's right. So for those of you who haven't been paying attention, Hewlett-Packard Enterprise has been selling off its Chinese operations into a joint venture with the Chinese government. When I say joint venture, I mean Chinese companies own 51% and HPE owns the rest. So yeah, it's okay. One of those old-style business models, which is a bit trade protectionist, where you make sure that all companies that want to do business in your country are all owned by your local businesses.
Mm.
So Tsinghua Holdings, or otherwise known as Unisplendor Corporation, fantastic names.
Wow, Unisplendor.
Unisplendor, isn't that fantastic?
I would not associate that with technology, but carry on.
There you go. They've acquired a 51% share of H3C Technologies, which has always been a slightly separate business unit inside of HPE. Now HPE, Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, and that company completed the acquisition. Hewlett-Packard announced that they're going to use the money on share buybacks, so they're either funding employee options or they're just going to buy down shares to push up the share price rather than do other things with that cash. That company will be an exclusive provider of HPE's server storage and networking. In other words, they'll sell that in China and also deliver service hardware support services. So HPE exists outside of China, and in China, HPE is effectively H3C. The flip side of that is that HP networking is now a confused situation for me. Anyway, we've got, you know, we did the Aruba shows a couple of months ago.
Mm-hmm.
So Aruba has now come into HP networking. HPE has the ProCurve products from a long time ago, and
right.
They now have the Aruba wireless stuff. But the H3C stuff is the Chinese stuff, and the suggestion is it's not 100% clear whether HPE will continue to sell the H3C networking or will primeline it. Maybe I'll try and reach out to somebody and get an update on that. But, you know, those H3C networking products, they're excellent. Those HPE routers that compete against Cisco, they're quite astonishingly good. And I just would like to know that there's some certainty and some, you know, consistency going forward on that one.
Okay, something to keep an eye on.
Mm. The business affects the technology, but not as a technology. It just affects the way that your strategy around it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, you can't really extricate those two things.
Not really.
Not really. All right. It is still reporting season, and you've got a story about Palo Alto Networks and several other security companies.
Yeah, bad week in the share market for IT security companies. Across the board, Palo Alto, Rapid7, Checkpoint, Vasco, Imperva, and CyberArk all got hammered after two or three of them announced their results. There's a lot of results announced this week. They all fell when several of them started predicting very soft Q2s. Security stocks have obviously been heavily bought up in the last year in the wake of Snowden and all of the breaches, and they've all been beating on the media scare has possibly wearing off, would be my guess. Enterprise IT really doesn't need the sort of security they're being offered. They need other tools, and I think share price has been run up, and so this might be a correction. I mean, even an exchange-traded fund, which just tracks a group of stocks, is actually down 10% year-to-date.
Hmm.
So if you're into security stocks on 1st of January, you'd be hurting. You'd have a world of butthurt right about now.
Yeah, 10%. That's tough.
Yeah. I don't expect it's going to get better. I think that security stocks are largely oversold and overhyped, and there's no real value behind what those things are doing.
Now, do you feel like this was just because of the hype around some significant breaches that we saw and that drove some activity in the market, or do you really feel like this is a major slowdown and folks feel like they've got what they need?
I think there was two things. One is the stock market thought that there was anticipated a strong opportunity. They think that, you know, because security is in the news, IT will, that people will go and buy more security.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some logic to that, but it's also not necessarily very good logic. It's not necessarily true. But I also think that enterprise IT has sort of looked at the security and gone, this isn't the security that we need, or they are also holding back on the cash. They need to slow down in face of some economic uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
Companies want to put cash in the bank. They don't want to spend it on IT as a general rule. Now, Arista also announced some results last week while we were away. They finished trading up 4% after beating Q1 estimates and guiding solidly for Q2, so above, slightly above the consensus from the analysts, still implying a 34% year-on-year growth. We continue to experience increased relevance and acceptance from our customers in the ongoing shift to cloud networking, said CEO Jayshree Ullal. I mean, I don't know what that means. But anyway, so people are obviously still buying Facebook.
You like us. You really like us.
Yeah, that's right. Gross margin was up, so 65% when they're selling those switches, which is nice.
Oof.
Nice for us, of course. And they're still going well. So even though Cisco's beating the hell out of them with this lawsuit, mm-hmm. also some rumors that Arista might be acquired soon. So the general consensus is that Arista's current position doesn't look great. There must be a way. They must exit. They must be bought up by somebody. But the question is just where are they going to go?
I don't know who the heck would buy into a lawsuit unless they're going to wait until it's concluded.
Yeah.
That would be bad.
Well, that was the rumor. Somebody was trying to say that, you know, Arista's already up for sale, has already done a deal with somebody,
mm-hmm.
and they're just waiting for the lawsuit to shake out before it actually completes. But, I mean, chassis don't seem to me to be like a big deal. The only people who want to buy them are big people, like the big, big cloud companies, the mid-range cloud companies, people who've got big data centers. The good part about that, of course, is selling it a lots of switches to a few people is a very cheap sale, but it also makes a very lumpy revenue. You don't know when the deals are going to close. You don't know how often they're going to happen. So if you've got lots of customers, your revenue tends to smooth out, and mm-hmm. you can see trends. But if you're selling to a niche market, you can be you can just find yourself irrelevant very quickly.
Right.
And you know, selling chassis isn't the future of networking as far as I can see.
Well, Arista is definitely something we're going to keep an eye on to see what shakes out for the company and this lawsuit as it wends its torturous way to a conclusion.
Yes, I don't know. There was a couple of other companies who announced this week. EMC VMware's Pivotal unit. I don't know if you know much about Pivotal.
It seems
very confused. They raised. They had a big round. They raised $253 million in a, I don't know, Q round or something. Feels like they've been raising money forever. But this time it was Microsoft, General Electric, and Ford that took part in the round. So, So what's actually happening is Pivotal's Cloud Foundry software is being consumed by these very large enterprises. And what EMC is doing is saying, why don't you come and buy part of the company to own a stake in it to make sure that it will never go away? Because it's an open source project, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so today it's now valued at $2.8 billion on a quarterly revenue of $83 million, which is eye-watering. A company with fundamentally, what's that? Let's say $350 million a year is valued at $2.8 billion valuation. That's extraordinary.
That's strange.
Yeah, considering it's an open source project.
Right.
But on the other hand, you know, Microsoft and Ford. I also saw some interesting stuff. They say $253 million, but I believe EMC kicked in $400 million of options as well. So it was actually more like a $600, $700 million valuation. That is really extraordinary. So interesting to see. I think Pivotal will feature, for those of us who work in enterprise IT, strongly into the future. And QLogic announced some results this week. The only thing you need to care about for QLogic is it's the SAN. And they got away with the numbers that they published. So they met the market expectations. They didn't actually exceed or whatever, which is good for them because they've been having a bad day normally for several months now. Other than that, Radware also announced they came down. They got hammered. Their results didn't do so well. So if you were buying Radware load balancers, which is the only product that I know of, then they didn't do so great. But that's not surprising. Radware's an odd company.
All right, and that brings us to the end of our financial reporting for this episode.
It was a little bit boring, wasn't it?
No, not at all. I think it's good to get a little quick hit, moving in and out. I'm going to throw in a quick editorial, if folks don't mind. As I mentioned, we were at Interop. We were cruising the show floor, and I was pleased to see that there were not a lot of booth babes on the show floor. You know what these are. These are women who dress up in skimpy outfits, presumably to draw folks in to talk about a product. I think it's demeaning to employees, both women and men. And in my opinion, it says, I can't get anyone to pay attention to me without resorting to gimmicks. So I'm pleased to see that there wasn't a lot of it going on at the show. And I think conference organizers, you know, stay away from it. Just don't do it.
Definitely don't do it. It really doesn't work. The thing that I've discovered is that, and I'll put a link in here to an article that was published on TechCrunch back in 2014. So just to be clear, I am violently opposed to booth babes. It insults me, right? I'm not dumb. I'm not an idiot. and putting some tits and ass on the show floor doesn't impress me, and I will make a point of not going to see you. Now, a guy called Spencer Chen in 2014 wrote an article where he actually did an A-B test. He had two booths at a single stand, and he says here, he said that my theory was that booth babes were actually a drag on LeanJet, and he was right. So what he did on one stand was he hired it with booth babes, pretty women, skimpy tops, short skirts, the whole bit. And over here he hired some older women, or some older people, but they were women. And the women came in, took some time to learn about the product, and he said the lead gen that he got out of the booth, out of the older women, was just astonishing. It was absolutely amazing. So what he says here, the booth was staffed with booth babes, generated a third of the foot traffic, as measured by conversations, and less than half the leads, measured by badge swipe, while the other team had a consistently packed booth that ultimately generated over 550 leads, over triple from the previous year.
That doesn't surprise me. And frankly, lead gen is tough, but you don't want folks just cruising by to look at somebody pretty or grab a tchotchke. You actually want folks there to have a conversation with you that might be interested. It's great to that we actually have an A-B test here to prove it out. So at your next marketing meeting, when somebody says, hey, we need some pretty women in the booth, slap that article down and let them know it's not going to work.
The general theory is that having this type of thing going on makes people uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And especially a lot of males who work in IT are uncomfortable around women in some way or another. We're not used to having them around. And having women in skimpy clothing around is very personally threatening. So we just won't go near your stand. I know I won't. I'm not comfortable with it. And it's insulting to me, right?
Absolutely.
Forget just remember, I never care about you. But if you think you can catch my attention by doing that, then you're not a company that I want to do business with. And increasingly, a large number of people are in the same thing.
Absolutely.
The only sort of people you're attracting are valueless.
Absolutely.
If you really want to attract an under 25, right. Somebody who's under 25 years old, who's ruled by baser opinions, you're getting leads, but they're not actually influencers or decision makers as a general rule.
Yes, generally worthless. All right, well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Network Break. Greg, if folks want to hear more from you, where can they find it?
You can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com and on social media either as etherealmind and on LinkedIn and all that sort of happy stuff.
All right. I'm Drew Conry Murray. I blog at packetpushers.net. You can follow me on Twitter at Drew_CM, and I am on LinkedIn too if you want to check out my official profile. Thanks to our sponsors, IT Pro TV and GNS3. You can find links to get discounts on great training at our website, packetpushers.net. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Network Break. If you enjoy the show, please like us on Facebook, leave a recommendation on iTunes, or share a link with your friends. Please check out our newsletters, Human Infrastructure Magazine, and Link Propagation. You can find links at packetpushers.net, and thank you for listening.